In the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, many people have wondered about the odds of it happening again and whether much of anything has changed on Wall Street. In his book, In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy, former mortgage-backed securities trader Larry Doyle asserts that the combination of banks, which are too big to fail, politicians who are too compromised to govern, and regulators who are too captured to protect, produces a, quote, incestuous cabal that is simply too big to trust. His book is published by Palgrave Macmillan, and I'm very pleased to welcome Larry Doyle to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, thanks very much for having me on the show.
And let's address that subtitle, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy. A conspiracy? By whom?
Well, that is an aggressive word, and I don't put it out there lightly. But the fact is, when you look at the amount of money that goes from Wall Street to Washington, which ran into the hundreds of millions of dollars and now well over $1 billion for every election cycle, what comes back to Wall Street looks to be little more than industry protection. But the impact on American investors, consumers, and taxpayers is little protection. The regulators are protecting the industry instead of upholding their mandate.
But are you also suggesting that the financial meltdown of 2008 and the subsequent economic disruptions were intentionally planned?
I don't know that you would call it intentionally planned.
Because not everybody lost out.
No, not everybody did lose out. In fact, what happened really was what was known as a control fraud. A control fraud, the very senior level people, both in Washington, Wall Street, and within the regulators, have all benefited tremendously.
Well, we've had some major legislation passed since the 2008 crisis and the creation of new agencies, but do you think much has really changed on Wall Street in the years since?
Ultimately, I don't. There have been certainly new agencies and legislation. Dodd-Frank is an architectural blueprint, but ultimately what America needs to understand is that Wall Street is a self-regulated industry.
And that leads us to one of the major targets in your book, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, or FINRA. If I'd heard of FINRA, it was only in a very hazy way. What is FINRA supposed to do?
America, to a very large extent, does not know what FINRA is about. FINRA is charged with upholding its mandate to protect investors, but the fact is it is funded by the industry. So Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, every other large bank, as well as medium-sized and smaller broker-dealer, funds this entity, FINRA, so that FINRA can in turn regulate it.
When was it created?
FINRA itself was created only in 2007 as the result of a merger of the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers, and the regulatory arm of the New York Stock Exchange. Those entities go all the way back to the 1930s.
Well, it's called Wall Street's private police detail. What kinds of powers does it have over the industry?
It has significant powers. The problem is it doesn't enforce them. And what it does is it really ends up providing protection to the industry instead of protecting investors.
So if it sees that something has gone wrong, it doesn't refer cases to the federal and state regulators that it probably should?
Well, it probably should. And this is really where I get into my book. You really need to look at specifics. I think the industry as well as Washington would like to talk in theory or generalities. But in looking at the specific levels of fines that are imposed on the industry, regulators at FINRA are nothing more than meter maids.
You know that although FINRA is a non-governmental and not-for-profit self-regulatory organization, it has a balance sheet ranging between $4 billion and $6 billion. Where does that money come from?
It's truly incredible. A large amount of those funds came from when the NASDAQ stock exchange, this was the prime competitor to the New York Stock Exchange, went public. Those funds rolled into what was then the NASD and ultimately FINRA. So it's a large money organization. In fact, unbeknownst to many people, especially in the industry, FINRA has its own internal investment portfolio. So let's think of that for a second.
That would create conflicts of interest.
Enormous conflicts of interest. Here they are. They're the eye in the sky, or dare I say, the cops walking the floor of the casino, and they actually have their own money on the tables. That's a problem.
Under the current fiscal deal in Washington, the Securities and Exchange Commission would receive $1.36 billion for the rest of the fiscal year. Why does the federal government's Wall Street watchdog have less money than the industry's own internal regulators?
I don't think you would say that that the SEC is overfunded. They're underfunded. But again, Wall Street ultimately answers and reports to nobody but itself.
And you describe FINRA as ground zero for the 2008 financial meltdown. In what sense?
Well, in what sense? When the massive amount of leverage occurred on Wall Street, when these investment banks tripled in size, who was supposed to be overseeing that? FINRA. And did they? No, they didn't.
Well, we have all of these cable shows that look at Wall Street. We have a newspaper that, in theory, is devoted to Wall Street, and the New York Times has a lot of coverage. Why has the mainstream press devoted so little space to FINRA?
In my personal opinion, the issues that I lay out in this book are almost too volatile, too explosive, because it goes right to the heart of the system. This is the intersection of Wall Street and Washington.
Well, part of FINRA's portfolio included $650 million of auction-rate securities. What are the ARSs?
ARS, the auction-rate securities. When you drill down, this was really a Ponzi-style financing, and the ARS market totally failed in early February 2008. Unbeknownst, again, to most people in the market, FINRA had a $650 million investment. What did they do with those bonds? They liquidated them mere months before the market totally failed. In my opinion,
that sounds like insider trading.
Insider trading or front running. And they protected themselves without upholding their mandate to protect investors.
The ARS market represents 10% of the money market, a similar percentage of the municipal bond market.
It was a $330 billion market. That's an enormous market.
So what happened? Is this something akin to what happened when Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme fell apart?
I would actually maintain that what happened in the ARS market dwarfed what happened with Bernie Madoff, just in terms of not only the size of the market, but also the number of investors. And what did FINRA do? They protected themselves instead of protecting investors.
The ARS market froze during the financial crisis. What did that do to the average investor?
Well, these are securities that were sold as cash equivalents, and they couldn't access their cash, and that had an enormous impact on people's ability to pay for their kids' education, fund their businesses, and a whole sort of other things.
Well, are the average investors at the bottom of the Ponzi scheme? How does the Ponzi scheme work?
Leonard, this is truly amazing, because what happened in the last year before that market failed, half of the ARS market transferred from institutional hands to mom and pop. So clearly the institutions and the regulator themselves, both the SEC and FINRA, were aware that the market was failing. And did they protect mom and pop? No, they didn't. Mom and pop ended up holding the bag, and to a large extent, they still do. 6 years after the fact, people still can't access their cash.
How transparent is FINRA in its own financial dealings and investigations?
Very limited. Very limited. They're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. There's a current friend of the court brief just filed in Washington, D.C. to get them to open up their books and records, and they fight this tooth and nail. Ultimately, they get the same benefit as a government agency in terms of absolute immunity.
Well, is that why if the auction rate securities auctions are, or were anyway, a Ponzi scheme, I don't know if it still works that way, and being manipulated, that the SEC didn't take any steps against them?
Well, that's one of the problems, is that the SEC has failed to properly oversee FINRA. And the General Accounting Office, through the Dodd-Frank Act, said, you know, the SEC needs to do a better job with this. But again, who really kind of runs the show here? Wall Street.
And as you said earlier, the Wall Street regulators at the SEC are little more than meter maids.
When you look at the level of fines that FINRA has imposed, It's not pennies on the dollar. FINRA's level of fines is about 0.1%, 0.1% of Wall Street's top line revenues.
How do we end up with a self-regulating Wall Street?
This goes all the way back to the 1930s.
We had the Depression. Weren't we afraid of allowing Wall Street to watch itself?
Well, we got the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, but they didn't deal with the over-the-counter market. That's the bond market. And in 1939, they allowed the industry to regulate itself in that sector of the market. This organization and their parents have had a very, very checkered past, and we're still paying the price for it right now.
My guest is Larry Doyle, who's a former mortgage-backed securities trader. He's worked for the First Boston Corporation, Bear Stearns, Union Bank of Switzerland, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase. He also served as chair of the Mortgage Trading Committee for the Public Securities Association and has been writing a lot on the field he used to work in. His latest is a book called In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Larry Doyle. His book, In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Larry, in 2012, state and federal authorities decided against indicting the bank HSBC in a money laundering case because there were concerns that criminal charges could destabilize the global financial system. In a sense, does too big to fail grant immunity from prosecution?
It does, but it certainly shouldn't. I mean, it's not as if there were some machines in there overseeing the money laundering activity. So why the individuals were not held accountable is the question I think the American public still has.
Well, instead, HSBC paid a $1.92 billion settlement. Is that just the cost of doing business?
Simply a cost of doing business. When you look at the returns on the amount of money that flows through these organizations, that's actually the return on this is significant. And you know, those fines are, you know, nothing.
But they were laundering money for Mexican drug dealers, weren't they?
No, it's not only the Mexican drug dealers, but also with entities over in the Middle East as well.
Engaged in criminal activities?
Oh, totally.
So this is not just a banking malfeasance problem.
We've got criminal behaviors behind this stuff, and it's ongoing.
And J.P. Morgan Chase just paid an even bigger fine. Also, without having anybody indicted. Is that going to be the way we're going to deal with this? It obviously helps us at the Treasury, but I'm not sure that it does all that much to correct the situation.
What this goes to the enormous erosion of trust and confidence in the system and the fact that the American public believes there's a double standard. I read that Madoff's report of looking into J.P. Morgan, and it read like a how-to manual for the operation of a laundromat in terms of the circuitous transactions. Just in very short order, you would say, this is clearly money laundering.
But in going over your book, I got the feeling that the whole situation has been made needlessly complicated. And so it's really hard for the general public to have any idea of what's going on.
Well, in my opinion, the industry, the regulators, and the politicians keep it that way. And we need much more transparency in simple English, and that's the manner in which I've written this book.
The government contends that it pursues fines in many of the cases because it's difficult to prove criminal wrongdoing, that they've lost in court too many times.
Well, the fact is they should embrace whistleblowers. They should embrace whistleblowers who would bring the information and the evidence. And what has happened to all too many whistleblowers? They've been ignored, intimidated, and fired.
How does the statute of limitations apply to the alleged financial crimes from the 2008 crisis?
How convenient that the J.P. Morgan situation with Mr. Madoff played out a little beyond 5 years. So they kicked the can down the road to the point where the clock ran out. And, you know, the members of the Department of Justice just, you know, oh, sorry. So it's very real.
Although there are cases. Right now there is a court trial involving SAC Capital. So doesn't that prove that there is at least a little more oversight in Wall Street than there was in the past?
What's interesting is what the Department of Justice has done is go after a number of insider trading cases. But from a historical perspective, we had 20 years where, you know, insider trading, as defined by the current U.S. attorney for the Southern District, was defined as rampant and routine. And I believe that these insider trading cases currently are actually kind of a distraction for the American public, while these large institutional frauds haven't been addressed.
Well, until recently, Congress could engage in insider trading, and that was legal.
Incredible. Incredible. It was only after 60 Minutes did an embarrassing expose about that activity that they passed what was known as the Stock Act. 9 months goes by, and what do? They kind of dialed that Stock Act back. So, with this book and other things like this, the American public is really starting to get it.
In the aftermath of the crash, many critics raised the issue of the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington regulators.
Enormous problem.
And then Treasury also. We see people who were at some of the places that have been accused of malfeasance and running Treasury.
Enormous problem. I mean, Goldman Sachs' business model is to get very close to the people in Washington, and then they revolve back and forth. It is an enormous problem, and that door should be shut.
Why do you think, if that's the case, because this is something that the Obama administration has been accused of as much as the Bush administration. This is a bipartisan situation.
Yep.
In his much-discussed profile of President Obama, New Yorker editor David Remnick wrote, "One of the enduring mysteries of the Obama years is that so many members of the hyper-deluxe economy, corporate CEOs and Wall Street bankers, have abandoned him." Do you agree with that assessment? Has Wall Street turned its back on the president?
Wall Street always hedges its bets. I mean, for every dollar that goes to the Democrats, an equal amount of money goes to the Republicans. And so they embrace. To me, it's kind of shadow boxing. Ultimately, Wall Street owns Washington.
The Dow is at record highs. Corporate profits are up. The Wall Street's done pretty well under the Obama administration.
Well, thank you to Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve in terms of pumping $3 trillion into the banks. The problem is the Federal Reserve runs one way for the benefit of Wall Street with the hope that the economy would recover. Hope is a virtue, and we need it, but hope is not an economic program. And that's pretty much all that we've got right now.
You note that the issue of Wall Street self-regulation didn't come up much during the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission hearings. Why do you think that was the case?
This, to me, is an abomination. Why didn't it come up? Because this gets right at the heart of the problem. They dance around the issue. You know, it's like shadow boxing for the American public, or dare I say, almost like the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. They put a show on without really getting at the heart of the matters.
You also note that the issue of Wall Street self-regulation, that self-regulation has become globalized over the last decade.
That's exactly right. I mean, Europe has a self-regulatory entities as well, as does the UK. It's systemic. It runs across continents. But, you know, what we've got is we've got... a debate over, you know, too much regulation versus too little regulation. What we need are appropriate regulations with real regulators.
Now, you mentioned that whistleblowers have been punished, but doesn't the SEC have a whistleblower rewards program?
In 25 years, they have had one meaningful award of $14 million. Aside from that, they've had about 10 other awards, and this is in a 25-year time period of little more than, you know, peanuts. So they talk about a whistleblower program, but they don't really put it into action.
A total of $160,000 in bounties over the last 20 years.
That's a joke, right?
My guest is Larry Doyle. His book, In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. You were in Wall Street in the early 80s. Has the culture on Wall Street changed significantly over the last 30 years or so?
I believe so considerably. I mean, the financial services industry, I would maintain from the early 80s when I got onto Wall Street into the late 90s, had the emphasis on service. In my opinion, in the last 15 years, they've operated like a zero-sum game and all the emphasis on the finance.
Do you think that the average investor is seen as a sucker by a lot of people on Wall Street? Or is that just the Wolf of Wall Street's image?
And you know what? That movie did Wall Street an enormous disservice. I mean, overwhelmingly, I would maintain that most people working on Wall Street are good people trying to make an honest living. In my opinion, the system is broken, though.
Oh, I was hoping it was all true so I could quit this job and go to work on for some brokerage house.
I don't know about that.
Were there times when you were there that you questioned some of the business practices you were seeing?
Oh, sure. There were times where you're like, oh, man, that's not pretty. But those times were few and far between, but yes, there were times. So I'd be lying otherwise.
Well, you worked in the mortgage-backed securities business, which we all now know were investments marketed as safe that eventually blew up the global economy.
Shame on the regulators, shame on the originators, and shame on the people running those businesses because it was garbage in and then ultimately garbage out.
What would you say to critics who might contend this guy made money on Wall Street during a time of deregulation, and now that he's left the industry and made his money, he's criticizing it trying to make money on that as well?
What I would say two things. Overwhelmingly, people in the industry have praised my writing. Overwhelmingly, including senior-level bankers with whom I worked. Additionally, people need to read the book, and the book will stand on its own merits.
Would you say that your outlook on the state of Wall Street and Washington today is kind of cynical, maybe with good reason?
With good reason. I mean, overwhelming evidence and specifics, as laid out in the book, transparency is the great disinfectant.
In the aftermath of the financial crisis, many small investors have wondered if anything Wall Street is selling is safe. Is it?
Index funds, I think primarily. Index funds are, I would recommend. But a lot of, you know, embedded risks are disguised, intentionally so. This is why we need greater disclosures.
You mentioned that Wall Street kind of divides its money, both parties. It spent $1.7 billion in campaign contributions between 1998 and 2008. What did that money buy?
Protection.
You cite a number of examples of financial gamesmanship on Wall Street, which hurt average investors, including excessive hidden fees and expenses in investor retirement accounts and predatory credit card rates. Has financial reform passed in the wake of the crisis taken on any of those issues?
No, it really hasn't, not in a meaningful fashion. Because you have to understand, right now, Wall Street is dominated by a couple of large firms. And their ability to hoard information and control prices to the point of collusion is a huge problem.
Well, Obama supposedly wanted to break up some of those banks, and he was dissuaded.
We need to break up the banks. For the health of our economy and our nation, we need to break up these banks.
What are the odds we have just a few moments of another major crash?
Very real, under a self-regulatory model.
Larry Doyle's book is In Bed with Wall Street, The Conspiracy Crippling Our Global Economy. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Leonard,
it's been eye-opening.
I very much appreciate it. It's been an honor.